Sunday.
Then it was really long.
You have plenty of work on the work.
Oh, yes.
Trying to do it every first row.
Oh, it feels point, so you had to get a new one?
No, I went anyway.
Oh, this is, I see, that's a long sleeve t-shirt.
That's right, but yeah.
At both ends, every four.
So actually, it's a society. So kind of one of the wise counters, she's the one who scored.
A small firm.
I know. Oh, thank you.
That's such a wonderful, it's not an addition, I mean, it's very interesting what you do, so.
I'm kind of enjoying my last weekend off. I mean, I think today I get back.
I've never.
Do you have parishes on St. Paul?
Lot like a church.
Yes, I started a mission church in Santa Barbara.
Oh. Technology. So it's kind of a fraud lawsuit.
Washington.
And I had such a
correction of the vendors.
My ministry was in that general area. Took out hiatus during the 70s. My bucket got real empty during the civil rights movement.
Right, right, you know.
Community in Washington Hall, I've already wiped middle class. There were two black kids in the whole city. They were adopted kids by my aunt.
Oh.
It was a silent agreement amongst the neighbors that they won't show any houses to black from an art.
That was on the subject. Our guy.
Oh, okay.
While he was there.
Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
Morning.
This week, we're looking at the Bible through the lens of the different kinds of writings. And yesterday, we looked at stories. Tomorrow is poetry. Today, all the laws. And as I say, who let the lawyers? Yeah, we have our resident lawyer here. So. Who let the lawyers into the Bible, and what's all this stuff doing there? Because fully one-third of the Pentateuch, or the first five books of the Bible, are law codes. And there are seven distinct law codes that can be identified. Now, we all know one, which is the Ten Commandments. That's a law code. It's telling us what to do and not to do. Why don't we read, we're going to read out loud the first passage, and then I'll give you a clue as to where to find it for yourself. But just listen to this. It has to do with a slandered bride. It's very typical of a certain kind of law in the Bible. Suppose a man marries a woman, but after going into her, he dislikes her and makes up charges against her, slandering her by saying,
"I married this woman, but when I lay with her, I did not find evidence of her virginity."
The father of the young woman and her mother shall then submit the evidence of the young woman's virginity to the elders of the city at the gate. The father of the young woman shall say to the elders,
"I gave my daughter in marriage to this man, but he dislikes her. Now he has made up charges against her, saying, 'I did not find evidence of your daughter's virginity, but here is the evidence of my daughter's virginity.'"
Then they shall spread out the cloth before the elders of the town. The elders of that town shall take the man and punish him. They shall fine him 100 shekels of silver, which they shall give to the young woman's father, because he has slandered a virgin of Israel. She shall remain his wife. He shall not be permitted to divorce her as long as he lives. If, however, this charge is true, that evidence of the young woman's virginity was not found, then they shall bring the young woman out to the entrance of her father's house, and the men of her town shall stone her to death, because she committed a disgraceful act in Israel by prostituting herself in her father's house. So you shall purge the evil from your midst.
Well, we're going to need a lot of stones around.
This is an example of case law. You know, if this, then you do this. There are also prohibitions and admonitions, but this is case law. What did you notice about the conditions of this? What are the circumstances here? Let's get that clear.
Getting married.
Yeah. For starters. Well,
and the woman has nothing to do with this. It's her father doing it, and it's the elders doing it. She's a very passive participant.
Very important. This points out the patriarchal, and I use that, I can use that word judgmentally, but in this case, I'm merely describing. You know, the men had the authority over the women. It's also important to note that they were very particular about certain aspects of her behavior. And what does this pertain to? In this one,
sex, and
what condition?
Virginity.
Yeah. Exactly.
Seemed like it'd be difficult to prove after you married a man and had sex with him that you were still a virgin, or that you were a virgin before you had sex.
Yeah. Ah, yes.
seemed like it would be a difficult to furnish much proof.
Yeah.
Up to date of the city.
Did you read that they brought a cloth? Like, are they proving
exactly.
that she bled on the first time?
Yes,
or something?
Yes. And who was to bring the cloth?
Her father.
Her father and her mother.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why this law is a little tricky. It sounds really, really harsh, but you think about it, if the mother and father are keeping the evidence for their daughter, I mean, in court, would that line of evidence hold up?
Well, certainly by ancient standards, yeah. And even in some modern codes, yeah, that's pretty persuasive evidence.
Yeah, but the custody of the evidence, it wasn't held by a neutral party, was it?
Good point.
So the parents are the ones who can provide the evidence, which perhaps naively, I believe that they can also easily fabricate.
Yes.
Evidence.
Absolutely.
So I'm suspecting that there weren't that many stoned non-virgins, but we don't really know.
Was there a custom where a woman, when she marries, would put a cloth to herself and give it to her parents, just as evidence in case?
Apparently, you know, so many things that were just taken for granted just aren't explained. Mm. So, but apparently, because they're talking about the cloth and that's the evidence. So we have to assume something like that. Yeah. It's Deuteronomy 22, verses 13 to 21.
Deuteronomy what?
22. Starts with verse 13. Let's read it again. My partners, okay.
Right.
Suppose a man marries a woman, but after going into her, he dislikes her and makes up charges against her, slandering her by saying,
I married this woman, but when I lay with her, I did not find evidence of her virginity.
The father of the young woman and her mother shall then submit the evidence of the young woman's virginity to the elders of the city at the gate. The father of the young woman shall say to the elders,
I gave my daughter in marriage to this man, but he dislikes her. Now he has made up charges against her, saying, I did not find evidence of your daughter's virginity, but here is the evidence of my daughter's virginity.
Then they shall spread out the cloth before the elders of the town. The elders of that town shall take the man and punish him. They shall fine him 100 shekels of silver, which they shall give to the young woman's father, because he has slandered a virgin of Israel. She shall remain his wife. He shall not be permitted to divorce her as long as he lives. If, however, this charge is true, that evidence of the young woman's virginity was not found, Then they shall bring the young woman out to the entrance of her father's house, and the men of her town shall stone her to death, because she committed a disgraceful act in Israel by prostituting herself in her father's house. So you shall purge the evil from your midst. What else did you notice about this law in this reading? Anything?
He gets punished, she gets killed.
He gets punished, she gets killed. Good point.
Punishment for slander, much less than for...
Very good point. You had a comment?
Oh, that actually they said.
Yeah, okay. And who is the restitution paid to? The bride?
The father.
The father, okay.
And the other thing I was going to say is that this woman has no choice at all. I mean, so he's lucky he gets to stay married to her. I mean, my reaction was, well, why would I want to stay married to this?
Yeah, I was thinking.
You think though she'd be mistreated?
Yeah, she's being punished
so she,
as well.
Yeah, what's to prevent her from continuing to be, well, abused?
Abused, mm-hmm. Right. Well, now we get to the social structure behind these laws, and this is why I find them so fascinating. I mean, in and of themselves, they're not so applicable to us today, but it's helpful to know how people were structuring society. First of all, we talked about the notion of virginity. It was obviously very important in the society. Mm-hmm. I read a lot of quite a bit of anthropology when I was writing my book, and you know, virginity isn't always prized necessarily in society, in cultures. There are cultures where it's better to prove that you're fertile and you can bear children. So marriage may be delayed until you've born a couple children. Makes sense. Mm-hmm. There are cultures where, regardless of who fathered the child, paternity is assigned to the partner.
Why didn't this husband just give her a certificate of divorce and send her on her way instead of maligning her virginity?
Yeah.
I mean, it seemed the path of least resistance would be just give her a certificate and say, but that's all you had to do?
Yeah, that's good. Well, what do you think might have prevented that?
Well, we can apply, once a woman was divorced, she didn't go out and get a job.
Right.
She became a prostitute or she died of starvation. I mean, there was no place for her. So. Even though it's crazy by our sensibilities, when you stop and think about it, it's really protecting the woman. It's giving her a place in society and a sustainable life.
Yes, she could have been sent back to her father's house, but that she would have had this non-existence. She probably wouldn't have been married again.
Right. Or she would have been, think of honor killings. I mean, she would have disgraced, if she was found guilty, she would have disgraced the family.
Exactly. You said the word honor. Bingo. That's the little chicken comes down and you get the prize. Honor, it's a honor-shame society. Honor-shame. And this is very applicable to modern day because we still see this in tribal cultures. That honor of the family is very important and it doesn't so much adhere to the individual as the family. So the husband, you know, if he gave her a certificate of divorce, then the family is dishonored and they have to live with that. These are small, rural societies generally. Things will shift as Israel moved towards a more urbanized society, but even so, most of the people lived in these small kind of clan enclaves. So this needs to be settled. And where was this settled? Where was this matter taken to?
To the elders.
To the elders. And it's very public. Mm-hmm. It's very public. So everybody knows what's going on. So in this honor shame society, it has profound gender implications. And several people have noted, well, this isn't exactly gender parity. No, it isn't. Women generally have to make sure they do not do any acts which dishonor the family. And men generally act to restore or preserve the honor of the family. So yes, the women are very passive. You know, they're not to go out and seduce men or even give the appearance that there's something sexual about them. Yeah.
I see an implication that if it's proved to be slander and the man is simply trying to get out of the responsibility of the marriage, the community is not going to let him.
Right.
And in that right. regard, it, in some sense, it's an improvement over our more modern laws of being able to walk out of the marriage, avoid supporting your children, and making it easy. So if the obligation was pure enough under the customs, it was not easy to get out of.
That's right. That's right. So the family and the children, forget if people loved one another. I mean, marriage was a contract enacted between the men of the family. There are a few other laws like this regarding sexual behavior around rape. There's another one having to do with slander. If a woman is pregnant and her husband believes that that's not his child that she's carrying, there's actually sort of a trial by ordeal. It's the only one in the Bible in which he has to go take her to the priest, and he takes some dust from the temple floor and mixes it with water, and she drinks it, and if she miscarries, then that proves that it wasn't his child. And so there are some very interesting glimpses into how they organized their society so that people could live together under very difficult circumstances. Does that make sense to you?
Mm-hmm. I mean, when I see a law like this, my two questions are, what's happening in society that they have to sort of codify this behavior? And then, mm-hmm. you know, and then more importantly, what are they attempting to encourage? You know, what's the sort of normative behavior?
Yeah.
It sounds to me like this is in a backdrop of some husbands trying to get out of their, you know, their obligations. Mm-hmm. You know, they're part of the bargain.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there's a very high value on virginity, but also social stability.
Mm-hmm.
Provide economic support for women and children.
Right.
Yeah.
Is this transferable to our day? Pretty much like this to the Middle East, to third world countries where women seem to be treated like this. They wear burqas, they can't be seen in public except their feet.
Well, that's an interesting question. I wouldn't want to apply an ancient law wholeheartedly, but the whole concept of honor and shame in tribal-based societies like Northwest Pakistan, Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia, some Arab countries. Yeah, I think
again,
it's
women seem
the
to
values.
Be the ones. Yeah, the women become the losers in all this.
Yes and no. I think when you think about burqas and women can't be seen in public, like Afghanistan, that's under the Taliban. That's the most extreme. It's also can be true in Northwest Pakistan, and certainly we hear of honor killings in across cultures. Mm-hmm. But having been to Iran twice, where, yes, women have to cover up and everything, women there are very powerful people. They're very strong. They have professions. They have education. It's a very sophisticated society. So I don't want to apply this just carte blanche to everyone. Until you get behind the covering, it's hard to know, really, what the power structure actually is. Yeah.
Well, it was interesting because I was just in Kashmir,
mm-hmm.
and the families that I met and that toured us all through Kashmir and Ladakh, all of them, and I was mostly with the men, the women were behind the scenes, mm. they were all in contract marriages.
Mm.
And what was interesting for me was to listen to their point of view as a man. They were very unhappy. And there were arranged marriages, and it seemed like, talking to them, that it was still quite ancient of a law in their Sufi. Muslim tradition, and that there were expectations.
Sufis, oh, interesting.
Yeah, it was really, so this does still exist, and a lot, and the women were way behind the scenes. I mean,
yeah.
Covered up, and then, but then you also saw working women.
Mm-hmm.
So it was interesting, it was a big contrast.
Yeah, this touches upon the gender structure in ancient Israel too, because once you get behind, you know, there's a whole women's culture going on that we know very little about. So it would have been very interesting if you had been able to not just talk to the men, but get into the kitchen. So there's a great book that was written in the 1960s about Iraq by a woman who went there with her anthropologist husband. It's called Guests of the Sheik. And it gives, she became part of the women's, she actually covered, and she became part of the women's culture. So you get the other side. And also there was a society with multiple wives. Mm-hmm. So so that, what we don't get in the Bible is that sense of the women's culture and what was going on there, because they control a sphere of influence, and it may be significant power there. They don't have the official authority. It's not the formal authority of the tribe, but they may have a lot of informal power. I mean, how many families do you know where the women
run the show?
Run the show. Yeah, yeah. So that's why I say, let's not make any broad assumptions about what was going on. They may have been terribly oppressed, they may have had tremendous power.
And a bigger picture, isn't God trying to mold his people at this point in time to teach them right and wrong? Or to be pure or separated from all the other cultures around them?
Ah, very interesting point. Okay, this is set in Deuteronomy. In what period? What's going on with the Israelites?
They're out in the wilderness.
They're out in the wilderness. They're about to go into Canaan. That's the story in the Bible. But if you look at the story behind the Bible, what we find is most of these laws probably came from the 8th century, like the 700s BC or later. And they were written back in to suggest that, yes, this is what God told us, this is what we did, this is what we struggled with. But this was a long process of development in actuality, which to my mind makes it more interesting, because that's our faith journey too. It's a long process of development. That's number one. Number two, in fact, other ancient cultures had law codes. Ever heard of the Code of Hammurabi?
Yeah.
3,700 years ago, they carved it onto a basalt stone, and at the top, the god Shamash is handing the laws to the king. It's like God hands the law, gives the laws to Moses, who then speaks them to the people. A lot of the social values were very similar if you compare the ancient law codes. That's why when folks want to put the Ten Commandments up in courthouses and schoolrooms and every place, I say, well, that's fine as long as you put the Code of Hammurabi and the ancient Assyrian code, and it didn't start with the Ten Commandments. Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, it's not unique to the Bible. That was also part of the Code of Hammurabi and a lot of other ancient codes. So there were a lot of similarities. Yeah. Did someone else have something to say about this?
I was just remembering that I'm old enough to recall when a lot of that in our own culture, when I was a kid, women did not generally work outside the home, and divorce laws were really different, and it was hard for women to get bank accounts or mortgages without their husband's signature. So it's not just those weird Middle Eastern countries. We have a legacy coming out of this as well.
And think how recent women just got voting rights.
Right.
1922 or somewhere in there.
Yeah, not that, yes.
Stephanie Kutz wrote
History of Marriage. I just finished reading it. And for thousands of years, it was this way, that marriages were arranged by a family, or by a royal family, or by the necessity of help. And even in our country, there were brides that were brought over, and there was someone who had to take care of the home, and that would be the woman, and the man was out farming, and he needed help, so they had children. And then they started a small lumber business, and they needed workers, so they had male children who would help. And so only in the last 150, 200 years have people been marrying for love. And that was very upsetting to society.
It destabilizes society in a certain way,
My granddaughter came from here, she's 18 years old, and before she left, my son said to me, I hope she finds a good Lutheran boy. Dating other. So there are still prejudices to try, and that tendency to try to arrange what
tribal.
And an ELCA.
I'm permitted to take communion. Missouri Synod Churches now. Let's throw an exclamation.
Someone had a hand. Yes.
I was thinking about the fact that passing on to the children the possessions, or later on when marriage was developed in England, to pass on the land also was very critical here. So the fact that she would be a virgin would then say, yes, in fact, she is my child, and my possessions will pass to that child.
Oh, thank you for mentioning this, because yes, the land passed through the sons. If there were no sons, there are laws in the Bible that suggest that women could inherit, but it was always the sons. So yes, you had to know that that was your son.
Offspring.
Mm-hmm. And that's
legitimate offspring.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Land was critical. Yeah. Someone else have a thing back there? Well, let's look at another kind of law, and this is in Leviticus. Leviticus 12. Leviticus 12. How many of you sort of sit down for your morning meditation and open to Leviticus?
Only as the daily office says.
I chose an example that has to do with women. But as we know, there are yards and yards of laws like this. Would someone like to read Leviticus 12? The whole chapter is just 8 verses.
The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the people of Israel, saying, if a woman conceives and bears a male child, she shall be ceremonially unclean 7 days. As at the time of her menstruation, she shall be unclean. On the 8th day, the flesh of his foreskin shall be circumcised. Her time of blood purification shall be 33 days. She shall not touch any holy thing or come into the sanctuary until the days of her purification are completed. If she bears a female child, she shall be unclean 2 weeks, as in her menstruation. Her time of blood purification shall be 66 days. When the days of her purification are completed, whether for a son or for a daughter, she shall bring to the priest at the entrance of the tent of meeting a lamb in its first year for a burnt offering, and a pigeon or a turtle dove for a sin offering. He shall offer it before the Lord and make atonement on her behalf. Then she shall be clean from her flow of blood. This is the law for her who bears a child, male or female. If she cannot afford a sheep, she shall take 2 turtle doves or 2 pigeons, one for a burnt offering and the other for a sin offering. And the priest shall make atonement on her behalf, and she shall be clean. Weird.
Yeah.
Is that in there too?
First of all, what do you notice about these laws about childbirth?
The difference between the law for a female child and a male.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Two sets of
huge.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I have been unable to find any explanation for why that's so. Scholars just are scratching their head over that one. The numbers are important, though. If you notice, if it's a male child, it's 1 week plus 33 days. That equals 40. And four and multiples of four were one of those special numbers, like 7 and 12 in the Hebrew Bible. It's like, or in LA, all the Chinese restaurants that have eight in their eights are really important. Oh. So they get them in the phone number and their addresses and in the name of the restaurant. So, and then if it's a female child, it's 2 weeks plus
66
days. 66 days.
So that's 80 days. Yeah. So wow. twice 40. So that's where the numbers aren't that weird. There's a reason for that.
I know that clean and unclean seem to develop with animals, with seafood, pork, various other things, and I don't. Yeah. Maybe God was trying to separate His people from the acts of other people that weren't His people.
Yeah, you've really touched on something significant.
Yeah,
yes.
I'm not quite sure how to do it. I mean, how to.
Yeah, when you see the words clean and unclean, that makes it sound like we're talking about dirt, but think pure and impure, pure and impure. And when we do that, then we can connect it to the pollution taboos, as the anthropologists call them. That's what these are. So, and they're very arbitrary, depending on the culture. Couple things. One is, what's the purpose of all of this purification, atonement, sin offerings? They don't use the word in this passage, but the idea is holiness. This is part of what gets called the holiness code in Leviticus, and was probably written by priests in the 7th or 8th century. Well, it's not clear when these were written, or when these laws were really instituted. But holiness, what do you think of when you think of holy? Because that repeatedly throughout Leviticus, it's to make a holy people.
Connected with God.
Connected with God.
Mm-hmm. Separate.
Separate, yeah. The Hebrew word kadosh actually means separate, dedicated, set aside. So the idea is exactly that this was a way to define who was God's people.
Well, then during a certain period of time, if she couldn't touch anything holy or come into the sanctuary, she was almost separated from God.
Yeah, yeah.
That's why she had to make atonement with.
Right, right. And what was.
That's unfair.
God was giving them a method to get back in right with God.
Bingo. That's it, exactly. Yesterday we were talking about, all this revenge stuff and this vengeful image of God. Well, here's this whole system that allows you to be human, because humans mess up. They, you know, biologically, they ejaculate, they menstruate, they give birth, and they also sin in relationship. And this is a way through the priests to come back into community. Yeah, what were you going to say?
Well, you were talking about, I just said spit. And yet Jesus used that for healing.
Yeah, yeah, true.
I was also thinking of just the natural biological forces of a woman when she has a child, with the afterbirth, the menstruation, the time that it takes for uterus to come back down to a normal size, as well as, you know, the nursing process. So, you know, I don't know if that simple biological fact would have something to do with coming back to a state of.
Huh.
Yeah, I gotta say, I was glad for 6 weeks of maternity leave. I wouldn't have minded eight.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, that's a good point. You know, she just had to sit it out for a long time, for a while. not a bad idea.
And then bounce back a little more quickly.
Yeah.
What's the big deal about blood? I mean, when men, also there are laws around, if men get involved with blood, they have to do things for purification.
Yeah, this is, okay. There was an anthropologist named Nancy Jay, and she looked at this whole phenomenon of blood sacrifice. So are you talking about the woman's blood, or are you talking about blood sacrifice?
Well, both. I mean, blood is, in various forms, blood is a big deal.
Yeah. With the women and menstruation and childbirth, now this was where the male priests kind of couldn't quite wrap their head around it, because, you know, women bleed, but they're healthy. It's actually a sign of fertility. Mm-hmm. So there's some of this kind of little male mystification about female biology in there. But when it comes to the sacrifice, it's a priest's handbook. I mean, just picture the temple. People are coming, bringing sacrifices. There are these mooing cows and these sheep bleating and goats, and they know they're going to be killed, and they bring them into the temple courtyard, and their throats are slit, and blood is... What?
Must have been a heck of a mess.
Must have been a heck of a mess. And the smell? Can you imagine? So, this is holiness? Well, so this anthropologist, Nancy Jay, looked at blood sacrifice in cultures around the world. And she found that, number one, they were generally done by men, almost exclusively by men. And that she developed a theory, let's see what you think of this, that sacrifice by men was a way to forge bonds between from one generation to the next of men, because women have a natural bond with the children, mm-hmm. a biological bond, but the men get shut out of that. But by appropriating these blood sacrifices, just as women bleed and there's blood in giving birth, the men also shed blood to develop this identity, and that sacrifice both includes and excludes. It includes, in this case, the people of Israel who were doing it, and it excludes everybody else who didn't sacrifice to their God.
Wasn't there a period of time when people thought that the soul was in the blood?
Was it?
That your soul was in the blood?
In the blood?
Yeah.
Wasn't it in the liver?
The soul was in the liver.
You know, I think that may have been like medieval. I associate that with the humors and the medieval, but okay. I don't know. Oh, the soul of, in terms of the Old Testament.
Was there any proof, or not proof, I guess, but history of human sacrifice in the ancient church, in the ancient...
You're talking about ancient Israel?
Yeah. Isaac. It's close.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anybody have any on the sacrifice of Isaac?
Well, my memory from seminary training years ago is that was their way of demonstrating that we don't do what our neighbors do. We don't sacrifice our children.
Yeah.
And there's even some debate about how much neighbors actually did sacrifice their children. I mean, kids died. A lot of babies died.
Yeah.
And so if you found places where a lot of babies died, maybe just a lot of babies died. And, you know, it wasn't necessarily...
Well, some cultures, South America, and others...
Aztecs.
It may have also been simply a way to control population. I mean...
Infanticide. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I don't think there was anything in our Jewish... tradition that advocated.
No, I don't find that.
I
don't find that either. And I agree, it's not really clear the extent to which other cultures did that in the ancient Near East. There are cultures that do use human sacrifice.
But there are clear prohibitions against child sacrifice.
Yes.
Which might indicate that it was going on somewhere, that they made a law against it.
Yeah, it's true. Why do you make a law if You don't need it.
You don't need it.
But this has been this group of people's way to separate again, the holiness, separate from the other cultures that we're doing, sacrifices of virgins, etc.
It could be, but of course, you know, that's a really good crime to level on your enemies, right?
Right.
You know those people. Yes. Sacrifice virgins. Don't want to hang with them. They eat their own kids. I mean, you look at early Christian, your early writings about Christians, and they interpret communion as, you know, Christians, they eat each other.
Well, and what Christians in the Middle Ages said about Jews.
Mm-hmm. Brain and blood.
Yeah, blood libel.
The blood libel.
So...
Well, there are bones that have been found. I think in Hawaii, at the cornerstone of buildings, there are bones.
Well, there are some cultures, I'm more familiar with Aztec, but yes, where there were human sacrifice. Yeah. Not
I'm
in
sure
anthropo-
the, I'm sure the incidence rate of this, of child sacrifice in most cultures is so low, but that it's such a, you know, a fundamental taboo that just to talk about it is a way of separating yourself.
Sending your child out to do a bombing with a backpack on seems to be a child sacrifice in itself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you can imagine if a culture that was foreign from our own, if aliens landed and they came to see the Church at Canterbury and said, there are bodies buried under every stone in this place. They sacrificed hundreds and thousands of people and laid them in ornate tombs. I mean, it would be an easy misunderstanding.
Yeah, it's hard. That's also true with temple prostitutes. You know, the other guys had temple prostitutes, but if you really look at the language, and an Old Testament scholar named Phyllis Bird, whom I recommend to anybody, she's very meticulous in her scholarship, and the language really is not about prostitution. These were probably women temple servants of some kind. But haven't you heard about temple prostitutes?
Temple Diana in Ephesus.
Well, the Greeks, that may be different, but I don't know about that. But in the ancient Near East, when the Bible talks about prostitutes, they don't actually use the word for prostitute. Yeah.
Male and female.
Male and female, yeah, probably not. It didn't. Wasn't really. They weren't actual sex workers.
The young men we sacrifice in war. Maybe they're 18-year-olds, but they're still sacrificed.
I want to look at another legal form in the Bible. And these are treaties. You've heard of the covenant that God had with Abraham, with Noah. These are actually, well, they're styled as ancient military treaties, with very, very similar to the Assyrian treaties of the same, of the period in which some of these texts were being written. They modeled them after treaties of that period. And they had various aspects to them. So if you look at Exodus 20, what have you got there?
The Ten Commandments.
Right. Right. So part of the treaty was a listing of all of the laws, and then there would be various rituals associated with them. What happens in Exodus, though, is that a whole bunch of other laws get stuck in there, but if you go to Exodus 24, that's really the continuation. Because what happens next is that Moses orders 12 pillars to be set up and oxen offered and the blood of the oxen tossed on the pillars. And this is the way that the ancient treaties used to be promulgated. Verse 7. Then he took the book of the covenant and read it in the hearing of the people, and they said, all that the Lord has spoken we will do, and we will be obedient. So it's a reading of the laws, and then there's a ritual is belief, enactment of what will happen to you if you don't obey these laws, only they do it with the oxen, and they dash the blood against the stones. And then everyone says, yes, yes, I do. I'll do that. Yeah. It's a ratification ceremony of the treaty, of the agreement or covenant. It's in Hebrew, it's berit, but we translate covenant between God, modeled on those treaties.
Verse 8 is pretty interesting.
Verse 8?
They dashed the blood on the people.
Oh, yes. Yes.
What chapter are you?
Yeah.
24. Exodus 24.
That's kind of unclean.
We'll assume this was pre-AIDS. Yeah. But yeah, that is interesting. Dashed with blood. What do you think if you were standing there and the blood is thrown on the altars and then you're sprinkled with the blood? What would that do functionally?
So make me real holier.
Visual reminder? What else?
What, make me real, feel real holy or throw up? Either. So make me feel real holy or throw up?
Oh.
Certainly would make a memory.
Would make, yes.
We sing, washed in the blood of the Lamb.
Yeah.
But it's like you're washed in blood.
Yeah. And
blood sacrifice is a very important term in some of our Christian circles today.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, if it's a symbol of life, if blood is a symbol of life, if mm-hmm. life is in the blood, mm-hmm. Then it's almost, it brings to mind for me, remember your baptism and
oh, yeah.
your sprinkling.
Exactly.
Easter yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which brings us back to the blood spilling of the priests at the temple and the blood spilling of women giving birth. Mm-hmm. If you notice the difference there, women give life, the men appropriate this blood ritual, and they kill. You get, there's a rebirth, a symbolic, there's a ritualistic spiritual rebirth that the men have appropriated, but they're killing something to get it.
And yet life comes from that too. I mean, they didn't just throw away the meat. Everybody got to eat, and this might be the one time that the poor got any.
Oh, that's a very good point. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I had to read through all of Leviticus to realize sometimes there are whole burnt offerings, but generally the meat was given back to the, some were kept for the priests, that's how they got their food, but it was, yeah, you're right, they got to eat meat.
And in an era before refrigeration, I mean, imagine you try to kill a cow and eat it with your family. Even if you have a very large family, that's a lot of food to try to eat. It's better to get the whole congregation together to accomplish it.
Good point.
And it's often given specifically to the widows and orphans. Mm-hmm.
To provide for those who don't have means. Yeah. Just one last touch on this notion about the treaty making. If you look at Deuteronomy 28, it's a whole list of blessings and curses. And again, this was part of the official treaty making. We actually have copies of Assyrian treaties, so that's how we know these things.
Deuteronomy
28. And there are a series of blessings. But have you ever read, starting with verse 16, you know, this whole list of curses that's going to happen to you? Verse 20, the Lord will send upon you disaster, panic, and frustration in everything you attempt to do until you are destroyed and perish quickly on account of the evil of your deeds because you have forsaken me. And that's just the beginning. You'll get afflicted with boils and ulcers and scurvy and itch. Confusion of mind, grope around at noon as blind people in darkness, a beast without
So.
It's temporary, the carrot
and the stick, yeah. But it comes from these ancient traditions. I mean, again, this is another sort of representation of God as this real SOB. But that's where this language comes from. It's simply legalisms, part of the treaty.
But wasn't God's treaty very simple? I will be your God, you will be my people.
Ultimately,
but
yes.
But it got more complicated as,
yeah,
as we had prophets and religious leaders and rule makers and deal makers.
That is the basic stipulation in the covenant between God and Israel. I will be your God and you will be my people.
Yeah.
Yeah, it actually was very basic.
Is the rest of this Adiaphora then?
Is it what?
Outward
stuff that doesn't
not matter. Really stuff important.
what do you say? What do you think? What is important in
it
all
may be
of this?
Fact. I mean, there may be facts of history, of civilizations, but how important is this all to us?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you look at the crises in our churches about what do you need to be a Lutheran or a Methodist or a UCC person? Can you be gay? Can you be a person who's been divorced? Can you be a person who doesn't believe in the virgin birth? I mean, these things become very complicated in our traditions, and a lot of churches split over them. Well, isn't it kind of helpful to see that it used to be that way, too? I mean, there's nothing new under the sun, right?
Mm-hmm. Hmm. I was just thinking about the IRS. You make this money, pay 15% your taxes.
15.
And now, and now the laws take so about these taxes take, it's become almost unmanageable to understand them. And here we had a simple law, simple set of laws that kept getting more and more complex to protect everybody or to protect whatever.
How does that happen? What's going on that it gets so complex?
We love legalism. I want to be told what's in, what's out. And it's easier rather than be wishy-washy. And
I obey the law, and those people
don't.
The more laws you have, and I obey them, those people.
Well, in some cases,
all those laws are for somebody else, because I'm doing it the
right
way.
I'm doing the right thing.
Well, in some cases, it was public health laws.
But suddenly you get divorced, or you have an accident and somebody dies, then it's you.
You can become them.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can become them. Good point. Did I hear someone say too many lawyers? No.
Some of it's case law, just like today, where a case comes up, a ruling is made on an individual situation, and then that becomes part of the law. So maybe, like the first one we looked at, there was a case where a man didn't like his wife and wanted to divorce her, and so as the judges thought about that, they ruled on that case, and then that becomes the law of the land. So there is some motivation to be working for justice, even if it gets too complicated.
I don't want justice under the law, I want mercy.
And yet I think that's one of the things we await in the coming of the kingdom, right? When God's justice and mercy are the same. It's impossible for us to see, but maybe not in the fullness of time, you know?
That was a good thought.
Yeah, thank you.
What is the connection today between the Orthodox or the ultra-Orthodox Jews and the literal reading of some of these complex rules?
You know, you'd have to ask a good Orthodox rabbi, but that is where the laws, the today's Jewish laws come from, mm-hmm. yeah, based on these texts. But
some of this stuff must not have withstood the test of time.
Well, there's no temple anymore, so there are no sacrifices. Mm-hmm. And one of the issues, political issues that comes up in Israel among mm-hmm. ultra-Orthodox who want to restore Jerusalem and want to restore mm-hmm. the temple, that's mm-hmm. not a huge number, but there are people, are you going to start to sacrifice? is that what you want? So, but a number of these laws, yes, this is the basis of it.
But that'd be a pretty hard sell.
I think so. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not because people are bad or anything, but there's so much more knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Isn't there also some attraction in, you know, not necessarily implementing all of these laws, but just saying, well, you know, this is what we need to go back to, and that's the.
The Pharisees felt pretty good about the law more than that, because they felt they kept it. God gave us his laws, we kept it, we're right with God.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, you wanted to say something.
I feel like people need guidelines on how to live their lives. Mm-hmm. So it comes down into the laws, and then the laws become more complicated and keeps expanding and expanding as society gets mm-hmm. larger. Mm-hmm. But we need these guidelines, which is why God gave them the guidelines in the beginning, because this was a very unruly group of people in the desert.
Mm-hmm. So can you really be a Christian looking at just the New Testament?
Oh, I don't think so.
We need the law and the gospel.
Right.
And it's not just the law, we need the stories. Mm-hmm. We need
and the
poetry.
Mercy and grace.
Yeah. We need the prophets. We need a lot of this stuff.
Well, you know, today I'm doing in my session, I'm doing a walk to Emmaus meditation, and the idea is Jesus walked with them and explained throughout the scriptures how and their hearts burned. So this will be, you know, a lead into that.
Oh, great. Good. Previews of coming attractions. Tomorrow, we'll look at poetry. I really appreciate you coming and sharing your wisdom with everyone.
Is there a comics section?
A comics section. Alas, no. Alas, yeah. So, coffee time.
Alas.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Do you know what you get if you laid all the lawyers end-to-end under the ocean?
Listen.
I like that one.
What's the punchline?
If you lay all the lawyers end-to-end